You're listening to the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Robert Trzesinski, senior writer for the Federalist. And here today in the studio with me, I've got Ash Skow from the Washington Examiner and Scott Lipsikem, a contributor to the Federalist and a lawyer who's having a lot of fun with the fact that his type is now elevated to the type that rules the world. And the way exciting. Things are moving. So on the line, we've got another lawyer, another legal scholar who's going to fill us in with a little bit more on the big decision that just dropped in the King versus Burwell case, the case about Obamacare. And that's Trevor Burrus. He's a research fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies. How quaint. Welcome on, Trevor.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, how quaint it is that you studied the Constitution and other historical documents that have no application in today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it wasn't a constitutional decision today, though. I mean, it has some separation of powers ramifications, but it was a statutory interpretation decision. It should have been fairly straightforward, but of course, when it comes to the chief in Obamacare, he seems to have a jurisprudential hole in his head.
Well, talk to us about that. I mean, what was the reasoning that John Roberts, because he wrote the majority opinion, what was the reasoning that he put together?
Well, it's an interesting sort of mishmash of purposivism, which is an old kind of style of reading a statute to try and make sure that Congress sort of gets what its purpose was out of it. But that has really gone by the wayside in statutory interpretation. For a long time, it seemed like a basic form of interpretation called textualism, which is when you just read the statute, and if it clearly says something, you apply it, and you don't really concern yourself with the fact that it may not be what Congress wanted it to be.
In other words, if they make a mistake and do the opposite of what they intended, that's on them and not on the court.
Exactly. I mean, the dangers of turning the court into a policy instrument that looks to try and rectify what Congress actually wanted, and then that's really clear in Scalia's dissent, because you could have one half of Congress wanting the states to be participating in the exchange system, which is one reading to say this is why the subsidies were withheld from federally created exchanges. And you have another reading that said, the Congress really wanted affordable health care. And so Roberts went with this Congress wanted affordable health care. There's a few contradictions that arguably emerge if you read established by the state in this way. So seven times in the statute, he's going to read the words established by the state and just ignore the by the state part of it. And the interesting thing is he never actually tries to explain why they would even do this. It doesn't explain why they repeated the term established by the state seven times in ways that make sense and make sense if you read it in light of the statute. He doesn't, did someone slip and accidentally write the words? He kind of has this part at the beginning where he says, well, because of the way Obamacare was passed, it's inartfully drafted, which is just a laugher of itself or understatement. And that seems to be his explanation for why these words are in the statute that he's going to now write out of the statute again, just like he did with the turning the mandate into a tax. So it's really, as Scalia said in his dissent, it should be called SCOTUS Care now, not Obamacare. They've rewritten most of the law.
Well, yeah, the question that comes to me is, some of us had certain hopes for John Roberts when he was nominated and when he was put on the court that he was going to be someone who was right of center. And this is an old thing. This is he was, and Justice Kennedy was a Republican appointee, and one of the other liberals on the court was a Republican appointee, Breyer. What is it that happens? How is it have you ever seen it go the other direction, that somebody who is, appointed by a Democrat moves to the right when they're on the court?
Oh, well, the classic example on that is, the other way around, is Earl Warren appointed by Dwight Eisenhower, and then going far to the left, and Eisenhower later calling that one of his biggest mistakes. I don't think we can really go there. But by the way, Breyer was appointed by Clinton.
He was okay. I had somebody else.
Suter was appointed by Bush, who was horrible. Yeah, but but also Thomas. So there you got back and forth. But no, I don't think we can go so far as to sort of say that John Roberts has completely left the reservation of being someone that libertarians or conservatives should respect. He is quite good on most of the issues, especially campaign finance, something that's very important.
So is it just that he has you said he called it a hole in the head earlier, but he has this like hang up about I'm not going to touch Obamacare. Is it the political ramifications he's afraid of?
I feel like that's disrespectful to say that about him. I think what it really is, and this is the scary part of it, is that these huge laws that we like to pass now, these massive laws, massive regulatory calls for regulatory action, and 900 pages of basic statutory language. They allow for a lot of the idea that you have to save it somehow because it's so big. So there's a sort of bootstrapping element. The bigger the law,
too big, it's too big to fail for legislation.
Exactly. Too big to fail for legislation. The bigger law you pass, the more you can, A, excuse like drafting errors because it's so complex, which the chief does in his opinion, B, find a general purpose to the act and read contradictions or other statutory language out of the act because there's the act has a general purpose. And you get those two things together, and I think that that's the way he's just looking at the law as this huge thing and not willing to, A, strike it down, so you have this problem of, oh, well, we're going to have a vacuum there, and people might think that the court is actually legislating. In the reality, the court, by doing what he did today, the court once again rewrote Congress's law for them to make Obama's vision, his erroneous and really horrendous vision, now just absolutely put upon us and inescapable.
I mean, is this, in a way, is this reminiscent in some way of what happened in the New Deal, where you had a lot of New Deal legislation coming up and the court was trying to strike it down, and it created this giant conflict between the administration and the courts, and eventually the courts sort of yielded and said, yeah, you can do whatever you like. You can regulate whatever you want.
It is to some extent, but don't forget the fact that, and this is, we need to go back and remember how we got this law in the first place via this. There was not a single Republican vote on either side. When the New Deal legislations were passed, there were Republicans who supported. There were some who had different ideas of what they would rather have. Some people, rather than having the National Industrial Recovery Act, thought there should be a 30-hour work week. That was what Hugo Black thought when he was a senator. So there were some Republicans who voted for New Deal legislation. This is the biggest and most divisive piece of legislation ever passed. And that's why, one thing we can't put up with when we listen to the piffle coming from the left is this idea of like, oh, sit down and take it. You've lost all this thing. Well, this is exactly why the Constitution doesn't allow people to pass laws like Obamacare, because the whole idea of taking half of the country and having them wrestle and pull the other half of the country into a healthcare system they didn't want is exactly why you don't want this stuff controlled by Washington. So no, we don't sit down and say, oh, well, now it's passed. It's Obama's law. The Supreme Court has ratified it twice. No, we don't do that at all. We say, you force this down our throats. And exactly, of course, Rahm Emanuel was the one who said, F them, we have the votes. They didn't even need the Republican vote. So now you're going to get what's coming to you. Unfortunately, the court hasn't been on our side, but we got more challenges up our sleeves. So it's not the end of this.
Right. Well, I think it was, I don't know if it's the Washington Post or the New York Times. I think it was the New York Times today that said something like, now that Obama's successor will have the chance to push people into, I finally liking this law, which I thought was a really interesting interpretation of what the role of the presidency is with regard to the American people.
Yes, exactly. And this is not, it's just not going to get any better. Future presidents, so the part of the decision sort of takes away some of the ability for future presidents to change some of these things. But it's not going to get any better. The law's going to get worse. And we need to try and make sure that the American people understand this and how bad this law is before we start bringing these more challenges, so we can actually maybe one day repeal this thing or change it, or at least make it voluntary. That was the one thing I was kind of hoping. If we could win this case, we could open up the law, and then we could have a system where it would be possibly voluntary for states to participate in it. Say, oh, this is an Obamacare state, but this one isn't. No, they wouldn't let that happen either. It's got everything or nothing, a 150-state solution coming from Washington, D.C., controlled like a marionette from Washington, D.C. That's how we do healthcare now.
And Trevor, you said something pretty interesting there that I wanted to focus on for a second. You said that there are certain parts of the ruling that are going to make it more difficult for the next president to change the law. Could you go into that just for a second?
Sure. So the ruling explicitly doesn't depend upon what's called Chevron deference. And this is important. It was an important sort of knockdown argument that we had when we were debating the law around the time of the oral arguments, that there's one argument, but the government realized they couldn't rely on it too much to say that there's ambiguity in the law and the IRS can therefore interpret this ambiguity either way to allow the subsidies to go for federal exchanges or not. Well, the problem with that was that therefore they're saying that the subsidies aren't that important, or they weren't important enough to have Congress actually say that they're needed. So it undercut part of their argument about how important the subsidies were if they're also arguing that the IRS could either go, okay, they get subsidies, or no, they don't get subsidies. So they at the very beginning of the chief's opinion, after he kind of gives this litany of what happened with other exchanges in other states that didn't have subsidies like this, he says, this is not a Chevron deference thing. There is no ambiguity in the statute. We're going to explain to you why a statute that is says one thing is unambiguously says the other thing, and it's not deferred to the IRS. What would have left it open for a future president would have been the ability to have the IRS interpret it, and then a future president could have interpreted the other way. That's not open anymore.
But one last thing I want to get within the minute or so we got left is, do you think it's actually in a way a good thing? Because, you know, if they had struck down the subsidies, the Republicans in Congress might have felt pressured to, okay, we should pass a patch to allow the subsidies because otherwise people will get kicked off. So in a way, this almost saves the Republicans from themselves in a way.
Yes, it's possible. The uncertain future of the politics of the thing, which is thankfully not my area of the courts, there are a bunch of things that could have happened. Some of them could have been bad for political fallout. But from a jurisprudential standpoint, this is unquestionably bad.
Right, because it opens up the floodgates. Well, thanks so much for having on to go through this. This is Trevor Burrus, research senior research fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies.